but it was a lesson that I needed. And I knew that after the race, it was nothing that I dreamed, but everything that I needed. And I really believe that whether you win a race or you lose a race, you know, you get those goals or you don't meet those goals, we're all doing the same thing. And that's, we're all growing.
Hey, on today's show, we're going to be talking to Sally McCrae, who just came off of a victory at the Badwater 135, arguably the toughest race in the world. And we find out a little bit more about the race, a little bit about how she turned a 2018 seventh place finish into a first place win in 2021, just 2.5 weeks ago. And that coming up in just a minute. Sometimes it rains on your birthday. Sometimes the line for coffee wraps around the building. Sometimes gas goes up 50 cents a gallon. Sometimes life stinks. Here's the good news. You don't have to, because Native has your back.
Native cares about the products that you put on your body. They're about stopping the stink the right way. That's the Native difference. You probably already know about Native's legendary aluminum-free deodorant, but have you tried their body wash, toothpaste, or their brand new mineral-based sunscreen?
It's good products, and they make great scents. They even have seasonal scents. Go to their website and check out their Road Trip collection or their Rosé collection. You can get 20% off by going to nativedo.com/trail or use the code TRAIL at checkout and get 20% off. That's nativedo.com/trail and use the code TRAIL at checkout. We love technology. We love our devices. And we're here to tell you about a really cool new earbuds by Ultimate Ear Fits. They're true wireless custom fit earbuds that change the way that you use your earbuds.
And if you've ever worn a set of earbuds for an extended period of time, you'll notice you'll get some tender spots in your ear. I call that ear chafage, Scott.
And they use a technology called Lightform technology that within 60 seconds, those earbuds mold, heat up and mold to your ear. Gives you great sound, great comfort all day long.
8 hours of continuous playback. And if you carry the case, you can recharge for a total of 20 hours.
It's risk-free too. They offer a 30-day money-back guarantee. Plus, you get free shipping, free returns, and a one-year warranty. You can get yours for 15% off by going to ue.com/fits and use the promo code TRN.
Welcome to another edition of Trail Runner Nation. My name is Don Freeman.
I'm Scott Warr, and we have a guest host today.
I'm Chrissy Mayle.
Hey, Chrissy, thanks for joining us.
Oh, I'm so excited. I wouldn't miss it to be on here with Sally.
Before we introduce Sally and talk about what we're going to talk about, you got a chance, Chrissy, to look behind the curtain, and you know the deep, dark secrets of Trail Runner Nation. Were you surprised when you saw some of these things behind the curtain?
I don't know if I have an answer to that, Dawn. Yes, I am so surprised. It's just shocking what has to happen back here.
She's going, that's all you have to do? All you have to do is press a button? That's all you do? Yeah, I thought you had skills.
They've got this.
Hey, we're gonna have a casual conversation with a not so casual athlete, Sally McCrae. And well, there's her laugh, so you can already know that she's on board. We have so many wonderful episodes with Sally, and every one of them I've enjoyed, and getting a chance to just have her bare herself, her soul, and some of her thoughts with us. She's very raw. She speaks organically. It comes from her heart, and I just love it. Aww. And she runs races that way too. And she's out there and just gives it her all. And she came back to a race that she visited in 2018 and said, you know what? I'm going to go back after it. And we're going to talk about going back after it today. So, Sally, welcome to the podcast. And which race are we talking about?
Don, you are so sweet. Thank you for that intro. You know, it's been 10 years since we did our first podcast together with you and Scott.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I remember. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. In July 2012, it was right after I ran AC 100, my very first 100. And I had the privilege of sitting down and talking to you guys, and really the start of just an incredible friendship with you guys and amazing conversations over the years. But I just have to throw that out there first, because you guys, I think, especially during that time, were one of the only trail running podcasts around. And because of you guys, I have met people all over the world that have listened to our episodes and our conversations, have joined in that laughter. And I'm just so grateful for you guys and what you do. So thanks for having me on. And yeah, I love you guys so much. But we're talking about bad water today. but that needed to be the part of the intro too.
Hey, Sally, tell us, I mean, you know this course better than all three of us put together. What is bad water? When you say bad water, what does that mean? What, tell us a little bit about that race.
Yeah, well, Badwater Basin out in Furnace Creek, you know, part of the Death Valley National Park, is the point in the United States. It's the lowest point in the United States. And back, gosh, like 40 plus years ago, you know, we had the first guy run from the lowest point to the highest point in the lower 48 states, Mount Whitney. That course was 146 miles. The race now just goes to the portal because you have to have a bona fide permit in order just to go and summit Mount Whitney now. So it's 135 miles. But the draw to this race, and I think the uniqueness of this, is that you start in a very harsh desert and you end on one of the most beautiful mountain ranges in our country, in the Eastern Sierra at Mount Whitney. So, and it's hot.
So one thing that I was, I didn't know this, and I'm embarrassed I didn't know it, because I've known about the Badwater 135 for many, many years.
Yeah.
When I think of the Badwater 135, I think of a straight paved road with yeah. no horizon.
Right.
And it's just straight. It has a white line that you have to run, and it's flat. It's not a flat course.
No, it's not.
I mean, there's three mountains you climb.
You know what? I love that. I love that you say that though, Scott, because when I first started following the race, like over a decade ago, it was the same thing. And even now, the coverage of the race and what you find, especially you go search on YouTube, it's just snippets and it isn't, or it's extremely dated. So it's told from like one perspective, maybe somebody that had run it. And really when I started training for this race this year, I was like, I really want to showcase the beauty and the truth behind Badwater, because, I know there's a lot of misconceptions of the race and just a lot of funny conversations that surround it. But, you know, there's a mystery and a beauty about it. But yes, you cross through three mountain passes, huge climbs, starting at mile 42 is a 5,000 foot climb over the course of 17 miles. And then you dip down into the middle, the belly of the desert, the hottest part of the race. And then you climb again for 13 miles. And then the course ends with a 5,000 foot climb within a matter of like 12 miles to get to the finish line.
Sally, you said training, like a key word for me. I'm so curious. You chose to go back. One, you've been there before, so you've got some perspective. Changing your training up, like, do you have a nice idea or sense of like what was the difference, or do you want to talk a little bit about how you got from 2018 to 2021?
Yeah. And you guys can ask away on that. I did try to be a little bit more open with training, what I was doing this year. I thought it was a great way just to share the journey and encourage other people in their journey. So 2018, I would say I went in with the difference between 2018 and 2021 was just really my mindset and my approach to the race. Obviously with every time we do a race, and all of you guys know this, the more you do a race or just racing in general, you gain that wisdom and that experience that you can draw upon. And so 2018, I'd say in my mind, when I stood at that start line, I really believed that I was the fittest I had ever been, and I was ready to run fast. And I, you know, it was my hope to win the race in 2018. And I had not a great experience. I made a lot of mistakes, and I really struggled really from mile 30 to 135 in that race. And so I changed my training and my approach and my mindset this time around. So, I'll let you guys ask specific questions. You kind of ask, cause I could probably talk about my training for like 2 hours, and I don't want to do that. So if there's,
You know, I have a question, and I think we should get into some of the training, because some of the things that you did were because of the experience you had previously. You came back, I imagine, as someone that said, you know what, I'm going to do it differently. I'm going to be successful because I'm going to make some changes. And we all need to do that when we look at races. We got to, what did I do? What can I change? And I'm going to implement that change. But as you were speaking, it made me want to say this, that I don't know if I've met anybody that races that, you know, wears the emotions on the sleeve like you do, Sally. And I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean, just you're very passionate and you go. And a loss for you, it's not because you didn't finish or somebody outraced you. It seems like I sense that you let yourself down. And you really internalize that. And it looks painful when you're not satisfied with your results. And I think that's what drives you so hard to buckle down and come back with the strategy and train even harder and spend so much time on the course. Because I think you carry a burden when it doesn't work out like you expect.
Yeah. And I love that you bring that up, because I don't talk a lot about that. And I know, Chrissy, you could probably speak to this too, because when you're able to get to a point as an athlete where you get to do it for a living, like it's your career, and it really is where you're investing so much of yourself and your life. And, you know, for me, becoming a professional athlete was a childhood dream of mine. So, you know, starting at, you know, 15, 16 years old, like I was getting in the gym, you know, I was working two jobs, but I was also like training twice a day. Like I would close up the coffee house and then go to the gym like at 10 o'clock at night. Cause I had this dream and this expectation of myself. And I never stopped doing that. I've done that for decades. It's just like really where my heart is. But I think the hard part of it too, is that sometimes, you know, people mean well, but they want to also project their own personal dreams and expectations of themselves onto you, and maybe even say, well, you shouldn't be so upset, because, man, I would have loved to get fifth place. I would have loved to at least finish. And that's really difficult, because then, you know, there's sometimes negativity thrown at you too, like, you know, as if you're not being grateful, or it's like it's never enough, or it kind of spirals out of control. And so you see a lot of pros and people that are really competitive, they start to not share their training, and they don't share their goals, and they don't say what it is that they're working up toward until afterward, because it's too noisy, and it's just too many people speaking in to your dreams and into your heart that actually have no place and don't deserve to speak into it. And I think over the years that I've learned that the people that see me day in and day out, you know, like my mentors, my family, the people I train with, my coaches, like it's a very, very small group of people that understand, like, yeah, second place is super painful. My goal isn't look like everyone else's, because no one understands how hard I worked and how much I dreamed. And, you know, so, and I'm really speaking from a general point of view, when competitors go for at that goal, you know, and they want first, or they want a certain time, or they want to be somewhere and it doesn't happen, it's just as painful as any other goal that isn't met. But I think it's also what drives us. It's what drives us when we come up short. It's like, yeah, but I wonder if I could nail that next time. And so I appreciate you saying that, Dawn, because yeah, it is true. I do, you know, social media only gives us glimpses, 15 seconds and frames, and that's it. But no one else sees the 24 hours, 7 days a week, 12 months out of the year, the very mundane things and the commitment and what we sacrifice to reach those goals. And when they're not met, yeah, it definitely hurts. And 2018 was, I think part of it was just definitely a wake up to my pride. Like I did go into that pretty prideful, not having enough respect for the race and even just how I started it. But it was a lesson that I needed. And I knew that after the race. I think I'd even put that in a post. It was like, it was nothing that I dreamed, but everything that I needed. And I really believe that whether you win a race or you lose a race, you know, you get those goals or you don't meet those goals, we're all doing the same thing. And that's, we're all growing. We can grow with a win, we can grow with a loss. And so I think going in this year, I just was way more aware of that. I remembered 2018 at my very core, and I kind of carried that in my training every single day that I woke up and every night when I went to bed. So,
hey Sally, you said at the beginning of the 2018 Badwater, you were in the best shape of your life.
Mm-hmm.
Were you in better shape this year than in 2018?
Yeah, I think I was. I think but I also think I trained differently in 18 than I did this year. And so I even think that my body was different. I feel like I definitely have, because I like racing like big mountain races. And then sometimes I will do little courses that we would call like faster courses that maybe don't have as much climbing. My body changes depending on the course that I'm training for. But I also make sure that my training meets, like if I'm training for UTMB, like my training just is so different. And so my body kind of adapts to like a big mountain race. So I'm a little bit more muscular. I feel like my legs are a little bit bigger. But when I'm doing more road races or faster stuff, I feel like I kind of lean out like a little bit more. But this year I think I was a little bit leaner in 2018. I feel like coming into this one, I probably had a little bit more muscle mass. And it's funny, this particular race too, like they do weigh you. And I walked up to the, at the start of our race, and I went up to the girl weighing people, and I was like, listen, I haven't weighed myself in like 2 or 3 years. I don't want you to tell me how much I weigh. She's like, I have to write on your bib. Is it okay if I run there? I go, yeah, it's totally fine. But I'm just going to turn around and don't tell me. Like I haven't gone down a path of like, you know, eating disorders or, you know, that hasn't been a part of my fitness journey, but, I do feel like it has been a conversation quite a bit because I came into this sport, bigger than a typical, pro athlete. Like, and so people have always talked about that. They've always said, wow, she's a lot bigger or muscular, or how can you run 100+ miles a week and have so much muscle? And I just believe it's just the way I was made. And so, I've kind of taken that path of just like, I'm actually not going to talk about that. I'm just going to show you what I do with this. Like, I'm not going to talk about my body and the muscle and all, I need to be this. And like, look at this picture frame. And I'm tired of people asking this. I'm just going to show you how incredible, like if our conversations were more just about what we're doing with our body than what it looks like. I mean, we all have different bodies. And so, I think this year, like, you know, in 2018, I was way more aware of my weight and like muscle mass and all of that. I got like a few like body scans to see like what my fat was, what my muscle mass was, what my bone mass was, like all of that. I was so aware of that. And then this year, I didn't do any of that. I just went out there and I trained very specifically. My whole focus was how can I be strong on this part of the race? I broke down the race and was like, how can I be strong here? What do I need to do to be strong on this part? Run fast here, climb fast here. And that's really, my body was just kind of like at that start line was like, this is what Sally looks like when she trained her best to do this race. And I don't know what my weight was. I don't know, you know, any of those stats, but it was a good place, you know, a good physical test for me. And I felt really strong the whole race. So outside of the diarrhea and stuff like that, which we could talk about later.
Oh, I'm hearing so many good insights into what was different for you. Like as you talk through all this stuff, I think it's awesome. And the body type issue, I love that you brought that up because I've often said that we're shaped by what we do. And
yeah,
you had such so great true. Examples of like mountain races versus road races. I've just thought of running has shaped this body. Like there's scars on my knees from falling on the trails, Chrissy. And there's muscles in my calf from powering uphill. Like it's all shaped by what we do. I'm also hearing a lot about mindset, and I really I'm kind of cooling into like that being maybe the difference in 18 to 21. Like even the difference of like going through all those scientific tests and then in 21 deciding, nope, not having that as a part of, was there some influences there maybe from a coach, or was it more personal? Like what drove that kind of mindset shift?
Well, I really believe and for, you know, everyone listening, one of the things I've always appreciated about our sport is there's still a lot that both coaches and scientists and, you know, experts are learning about our sport and what we do and what's possible. And so when I line up at a 100-mile race or, you know, Badwater, my thought is like, wow, look at all these people that are like pushing the boundaries of what we thought was possible. And I, you know, I think so often people are like, ultra runners are crazy. I'm like, no, ultra runners are courageous because they're actually going out and testing what hasn't been tested. And for me, like, I really believe that what I learned in 2018 was you can't just come to Badwater fit. You have to come like with great respect for what you're about to do, but you should have also done your homework because this race is so unique and the elements that you have to endure, not just because it's hot, but how many people actually have the opportunity to run in such extreme heat for more than an hour, more than 2 hours. Like, I think people can say like, oh yeah, I've run a marathon like in 90 degree heat. Like that was insane. And yeah, maybe it took 4 hours, 5 hours, whatever, but can the human body actually run well for 20, 25, 30 hours in extreme heat and actually do well? And so that's kind of where I started with my training was like, I need to be a student of the sport. I should never, ever think that I'm all knowing just because I'm a pro or I've been in the sport for a long time. I should always be looking for ways to learn. And, you know, I love training. I love being in the gym. I love running. I love going up mountains. Like that part is easy for me. That part's easy to do. I'm not searching for motivation to get out and train my body. But what is hard to do is the stuff that is boring and that takes up a lot of time that maybe I don't want to do. And so I knew I needed to start studying because one of the biggest problems I had in 18 was getting the proper electrolyte and calorie balance for that type of weather. I don't think that endurance athletes and ultra runners have a hard time understanding that we need calories and electrolytes when we run. Like, you're not going to get to the finish line if you're not eating and you don't have proper electrolytes. We all know that. But I think what I wasn't respectful of was that, you know, running in 80 degree weather and what my body's able to ingest and what I'm able to keep down is very different than when it's 125 degrees out. My body is after a few hours is starting to say like, hey, are you really doing this? Like, this is insane. Like, I'm going to start shutting your organs down if you know? And so I took a lot of time to study. I looked up tons of really fascinating lectures on YouTube, on heat training, on athletes, on endurance. I listened to podcasts. I scoured as much as I could. And what I learned was like, wow, if there's any case studies that are done on athletes in extreme weather, it's like 90 minutes. It's like we put them on a bike in 100 degree temperature for 90 minutes. I'm like, hey, anyone looking at athletes that are doing this for 20 hours in full exposure in over 120 degree heat? And I'm like, wow, yeah, Badwater athletes. Like, and so then I started to just kind of build from there. I started to go out and conduct my own experiments. So the last 6 weeks before Badwater, I'd spend half the time in the desert and then half the time at home. And it was like with my notebook. And I would also go to like Palm Desert too, because sometimes Palm Springs area was hotter than the course. And I wanted like a specific temperature. So sometimes I would go to Lone Pine because it was like, okay, it's 105 in Lone Pine. So I'm going to do all of this running with these electrolytes and different calories and see how fast I can run in 105. And then I'd go to Furnace Creek because I knew it was going to be 125. And I'd see, okay, how long, you know, what am I able to eat and drink? What do I need in that weather? And then I would go somewhere else. And then I'd come to the beach because here in Huntington Beach, it gets 80, 90% humidity. It's not super hot. It's like 70, 80 in the summer. So then I'd layer up and I'd run in humidity and see what kind of calories I needed. And it was just weeks and weeks of that, of taking notes on myself and learning about myself so that when it came time for my crew and to educate my crew, I'd say, you have to tell me when you know what the temperature is, because then I can do calculations in my mind. So if you tell me that it's 100, I'm be stoked because I know that I can eat at that time. I can get in more and I know I can pick up the pace. But once we go past 115, like 120, like we're going all liquid. Like, don't try to feed me. I'll probably bite your head off if you do, because I get really cranky at that time, you know? And it was just, I had to be respectful of the fact that it doesn't matter how fit I am. It doesn't matter how long I've been doing this sport. I have to respect the unknown with this weather, the exposure and the intensity of running in the desert. It's just like no other race that I've ever done. So that was the educational knowledge part of the mindset. And we can talk about the emotional and during the race later, but.
So really quick, I found that fascinating, Sally. It wasn't just the type of calories or the amount or timing of electrolytes. It was also dependent on the temperature. I have never thought of that, that experimenting with, if the temperature gets to this level, I need to switch to the type of calories, to liquid calories, or I need to increase or decrease the frequency of my electrolytes.
Yeah. And there's not a lot out there. I think that's when the race really started to become my own in my training. And I thought, man, this is so fascinating because, you know, humans, we're so deep and vast and mysterious. And there's so much that we don't know. Like, I think that even, you know, I respect science. I love what science brings us. But if a scientist were to spend their entire lifetime studying me, there's so much that they'll never get to. They might only get to about 10% of understanding me. And so I thought, how amazing that we get to spend our lives learning about ourselves and truly act, if we can take a step just in that belief and say, maybe I am a little bit more capable than I think. Maybe I am stronger. Maybe I can push a little more. I'm going to try this. Okay. I'm going to push a little more. I'm going to do this again. And it became fun. And even after crossing the finish line, I was like, okay, I know what I need to change next time.
You know, we've talked a lot. Did we mention that Sally won the race? I don't think so. What a humble runner she is, not to say, hey, by the way, I won this thing. So my hat's off to you. But, you know, as a runner over the years, I've heard all kinds of stories about bad water. So we're going to kind of round table a few questions, kind of a quick fire and answer back. And I want to know, is it true that if you don't run on the line, your shoes will melt? Is that true or false?
You know what, Don? Here's my couple takes on it. Okay, so I ran it in the hottest year in the history of this race. It was 127 Fahrenheit, which I think is about 53 Celsius. You know, my shoes didn't melt. I wore, I think, two pairs of shoes that year. This year, I wore two pairs of shoes. I wore one pair for like 20, 25 miles and then one pair for the rest of the race. And my shoes didn't melt. My thought on that though, because people have said, there have been racers who have said that, is either they were like standing in place for like a while, like maybe they were sick and not feeling that great. And maybe that is what caused like the melting, or it was just like the material of that shoe. And I know that materials have changed and gotten better and they're using different materials than they did. And this race has been around for so long, but I haven't seen it. It would be fun. I mean, how cool would that be? Just like this gooiness. Like, what picture would that be? Like, she's melting. No, she's literally melting. But yeah, no melted shoes.
Speaking of materials, I was noticing in some of your photos, I'm guessing during the night, you were more like tank top, shorts, like get as much skin exposed yes. as possible. And then during the day, like the big hat, floppy hat, long yeah. sleeve, but you didn't cover your legs. And I was curious if that was intentional. And that also brings up another little point about your crew. Amazing. We'll get to them. I want to talk about your yeah. crew, but let's Good, talk materials and like your choices on like covering and not, or that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So I did train with different, all different types of gear in all my training, which was fun to share with people. You know, in the journey, it was more of like a comical thing at times because, you know, Nike had sent me these thigh highs, like literally thigh highs, which were really comfortable and great. And they're easy to get on and off, you know, instead of wearing like tights or whatever. But covering your skin from the sun when it's on you directly, it is helpful because the thing that the elements do out in the desert is that exposure, it wears you down. I mean, it tires you out. So, covering your body from that heat, which a lot of times when we go out running on a hot day, we want to take off the shirt and we don't want the hat anymore. Like we just want as much like air and we want to breathe as much as possible, but it can actually be pretty dangerous when that sun is just beating on the skin. And so what I did is same thing. In different temperatures, I practiced with different clothes, and I kind of felt out different materials. So I would try like when we went out to Palm Desert, it was 118, and I thought this would be a great time to practice a wet cotton t-shirt. So I did this like so many, like I did 6 out and backs of a couple miles each from my hotel. I completely drenched like a cotton t-shirt, put it on and started running in 118 degree heat. Within 5 to 7 minutes, the thing was completely dry. And so I thought, well, this is, so then I would go back and try it again. Well, maybe I didn't wet it enough. Okay, let me try a different cotton t-shirt, like maybe something thinner. So then I tried a different weight of a t-shirt. But every time it was like 5 to 7 minutes. So I thought, okay, that actually isn't helpful because now it's just this heavy cotton t-shirt and I don't want to waste time with my crew trying to keep it wet. It felt good for a few minutes and then, okay, that's just ridiculous. So then I noticed that when the heat would rise beyond 110, that my legs really would feel hot because then you're the heat coming off the road on the, you know, that it's a lot hotter than the air temperature. And so covering my legs felt great. When I looked at the temperature for the race day, I thought, well, it looks like there's only a section where the heat is going to be extreme. And so I don't know if I want to mess with anything on my legs. But what I do know is that when you spray suntan lotion, that that actually does help with the heat radiating onto the skin. And so we just decided to do that. Like I had my crew like spray my legs when I was feeling it. And it was only just like a section of the course where I really felt like my legs were hot. But outside of that, it's just covering up from the sun. It just saves like both the fatigue and just like the, even like the mental breakdown that you kind of get from sun directly hitting you. So I wore a sun hat in 2018, which was great. Covering up my arms completely was really good. And then just spraying the back of my legs when I needed it, seemed to be the best fit. But as soon as that sun, you know, started setting, I was like, get it all off. Let's get back in a tank top.
Right on. And then for race day, like where was your choices? Mm-hmm.
So race day, I did start with like a different pair of shorts, and then they started chafing me like at 20 miles in. And so I was like, screw it. I just like, give me my black go-to shorts that I wore all the time in racing. That's pretty much what I raced in. I didn't really change anything else outside of that. The goal for me was like, I need to wear something that isn't moving. I hate it when things move and shift. And I think, you know, this idea that you have to wear white, you really don't. I took a lot of time studying colors and like the clothes that the Bedouins wear, like desert dwellers, and it's really fascinating. And so I actually practiced with different types of materials and even this really big flowy windbreaker that I had to get what they call the chimney effect, which works when it's really windy. So, if it's really windy, you can wear something that's like flowy, and what happened, even if it's like black, which is actually more ideal because, you know, reflecting the sun with the white isn't what you want. But if you wear black, it kind of absorbs it. But then if it's windy, it creates a chimney effect inside of you and it actually, cools you down. So it like the wow. Air kind of goes off you and, that's why they wear all that flowy clothes, like right. The desert dwellers. Like it's amazing. And I thought, you know, I've always been fascinated that they don't, not all of them wear white, like some wear black mm-hmm. and blue mm-hmm. and pastels. And so I started studying like why, you know, what are these colors and what does that have to do? And so I experimented with different colors. I stuck to mainly just black and white. And I did that the year before. But you'll find studies on both. Some, you know, some people, scientists will say, no, black is the color you should be wearing. And then other people say, no, it should be white. So that's always an exciting argument to have with people, which some people kind of had on social media with me, which I loved, you know, because there's still so much that we can learn about it.
We want to take a break from our podcast today with Sally McCrae and tell you a little bit more about Path Projects.
Path Projects has developed all their running shorts with separate base liners. This virtually eliminates all chafing.
The base liner stays in place and wicks away the moisture, and the shorts ride on top of that, and they can move independently without rubbing against your skin.
That's going to be super important if you're running Badwater or any race that you need to finish. And you can get personalized performance with base liners that have the choice of 3 fabrics and 4 links. This allows you to dial in exactly what you need for the weather condition or personal preference.
Go to pathprojects.com because that's the only place you can get their gear. They have shorts, they have base liners, they have shirts, they have headwear. Go check them out at pathprojects.com.
And now back to the show with Sally McRae. Badwater is unique, in a lot of ways. One, we hear it's a furnace, and we learned the shoes aren't melting, but you do have a van that accompanies you along the way. And on a typical trail race, we get to see someone every 6 to 12 miles. We go to a little aid station that is the best place in the world. But you have a van. Does it follow you directly? Do you have access to it? Do you direct the frequency? Tell us about the van.
Yeah, this is a great question and is mysterious, I know, to a lot of people. So because of the extreme weather, we're not going to get a whole lot of volunteers. You're going to want to sit in 120-degree heat and work an aid station. So your car is your aid station. You are able to have up to 4 people as your crew. So typically people will have like a crew chief, and then, you know, within that crew, people will volunteer to pace. You can have people begin pacing you at mile 42. Unless you're 62 years old, then you can have them start pacing you at mile 3. There is a lot of rules. They have to wear like the class 3 reflective gear. They can walk across the street to you. So as you're running up, you can grab a water bottle from them. Pacers are allowed to pace you from behind. They can pass you something. They can come up next to you and give you something or hold something for you for a minute if you need to like adjust or whatever, but they have to stay behind you. And then, just as far as like what they're carrying, you know, Badwater really suggests, you know, have someone on your crew that is maybe medically trained, first aid trained. So, you know, a lot of people have like a nurse or a doctor, or just someone that's helpful in that area. It's also helpful to have some type of veteran, whether it's someone that's crewed before, paced before, or is run it themselves. But all throughout your lead up to the race, the entire crew is given all the same information as the runners, and they are expected to know all the rules and the turn by turn of the course, and really follow all of the rules. There's a lot of rules for them, but the role of your crew is to make sure that you're safe, because I'll tell you what, and when that temperature starts rising, you can feel amazing. And within 2 minutes, just go into some type of heat shock or stroke or anything. It's just amazing how things can turn so quickly. So really your crew is just kind of monitoring you, making sure you're okay. How are we doing? You know, talking to you. And they are supposed to, they want you to maybe keep it at about every mile that they can stop the crew car. But sometimes, especially at the hotter parts of the race, they'll stop a little bit more frequently.
Sally, that's a great question. Are they leapfrogging you? So do they drive 4 miles down and stop, or are they in first gear going 3 miles an hour?
Yeah. So they are not allowed to pace next to you. You can get in trouble for doing that. So what they'll do is they'll give me what I need, and then they drive ahead. Sometimes they'll wait, like they'll sit in the back and kind of watch me run for like a few minutes and just make sure that I'm okay. And then they'll drive by, like sometimes they'll roll down their window and be like, good job, you know, but they are not allowed to pace with you. So they do need to drive ahead. And really the rangers out there they're monitoring it the entire time. So like my husband, Eddie, drove quite a bit. He got in trouble one of the times because his tire was partly on the white line when he pulled over. So they're watching everything that you do. You can't slow down. You have to be, you know, when you park your car, you can't touch that white line at all. So yeah, the crew's really scrutinized. And again, they need to be in front of the runner, not pacing the runner.
What about the camaraderie between pacing vans or vehicles? Is there a lot of help between other runners? Is it similar to what you experience on a dirt trail run with other crews and co-runners?
Yeah. You know, if this year I was really, really lucky to be able to come across the path of friends. And we had one crew car give us a Coke when I was at a really low spot. That was like the only thing I could think of that I could get down. And we didn't have that in the car. And so the guys went and asked another crew, any chance you have a Coke for Sally? And so that was super cool. The neat thing about Badwater is that there's over 20 countries represented. So, you know, even in like pre-race and stuff like that, like there are some language barriers and there isn't the same type of mingling, I guess, that you would necessarily see because it's such a small group of people. But by the time it's like post race, I feel like there's a lot more camaraderie like at that time. But anytime we would pass people during the race or anything like that, I mean, there's just all the athletes out there have so much respect for each other because everyone is feeling it. We're all feeling the same thing. So I'll tell you, anytime we came upon a runner, they'd always want to talk. They always had encouragement and, you know, and we would do the same thing. The community is very, very supportive and kind.
Hey, so we're still in the van and the vans have air conditioning.
Yeah, to a degree.
Well, I mean, more air conditioning than your umbrella chimney program you're talking about.
Yeah.
Does a runner get in the van? Can they cool down in the van? Or do you even dare risk getting into a cooler environment? Or you just keep it hot? What's your move?
Yeah, runners are allowed to get into a parked van, into their crew van, as long as it doesn't move. This can really save a runner, especially if a runner is maybe in a dangerous spot, if they are having a heat stress reaction. That air conditioned car, you know, being in that for 10 minutes or even an hour can really help cool their system down and get them back on the course. In 2018, I did have a pretty rough go at the race. I was in that car quite a bit. You know, my crew didn't let me stay in a long time, but it was like 3 minutes here, 5 minutes there, 10 minutes here, 12 minutes here. This year, I think they let me at mile 83, I hit an all-time low and I don't remember a ton. I was a little dizzy. I was like grumpy Sally and they let me sit on the edge. I was like, let me lay down, please let me sleep. They're like, no, you can sit on the sliver right here for 2 minutes. So they let me do that and tried shoving blueberries in my mouth. And they said, now get back out on the road. So that was about it for me.
Did they ever put you in the cooler? I remember pictures of Scott Jurek, like 6'2" Scott Jurek, right? like folded into a little, I don't even know, yeah, in a cooler. Did you ever try that?
No, we never did that. We did have two coolers and you know what? That is a great way to get somebody's body cooled down, especially if they are having a really bad reaction to the heat. You need to do that. You need to get them on their back and elevate their feet. And it is like put ice all over their body as fast as you can. So that is a common out at this race. Like most everyone will have like a bucket or something if that ever needs to happen.
So I was going to bring that up, Chrissy. I'm really glad you did because I can still see that iconic picture of Scott Jurek trying to himself in this cooler.
Yeah, yeah.
How many pounds of ice did you go through? What does it take to do Badwater?
Yeah, so I need to ask my crew that. I was pretty adamant about telling them. I said, listen, I never trained with ice. Ice is a luxury that I will not depend on. And so I never trained with ice. And so I just said, hey, if you got it, like, yeah, it'd be awesome to have a cold drink and it would be awesome to have it in my sports bra. But I did not expect it. But I do feel like that when they could, you know, they would come out with this little packable cooler and then there'd be like a few cubes down there and we'd shove it in my sports bra. But I didn't do like the ice bandana. I didn't do that. I actually tried a different way of cooling because I think that ice can sometimes feel so extreme that can also shock your body, even it being so hot. So unless you're like in a really bad place, if you're trying to move well, you don't want to be at, even you're in extreme heat. I don't think that ice is always like the best thing to do, but cool water, when the water is cool, is going to be really effective. So I did more of that. I used a lot of cool water, just constantly dousing my face, my head, and my hands.
Hey, Sally, I've seen a lot of through hikers, especially ones that are going hiking the PCT through the desert mm-hmm. of Southern California, that use these little hiking umbrellas that are silver that reflect. I don't think I've ever seen a runner at Badwater using an umbrella. Have you thought of that?
Or were there people doing that?
Oh, it is.
So crew can have it. Like if they're standing outside, because they're constantly opening up that car.
Yeah.
And then if I were to come over, like if I was sick and I were to like come over and they're trying to cool me down, I can stand in place and they can put it over me. But you can't have those. Because there's the hats. You know, you've seen the hats, like the umbrella hat that you put on your head. Yeah, you can't have that. You can't have any type of cooling system. You know, you can't wear like a, you know, you see runners in the Olympics right now with those big ice vests that they put on before they head out on the track. You can't have anything that is like made for that. So,
how about the Philadelphia Eagles beer hat? You know, with the two beers hanging on,
right? Yeah, you're just coming down.
Is that legal?
I'm sure it is.
I remember on a real hot long trail run on a race. And the guy was carrying one of those umbrellas, and it was very, very windy. And from our view, because we were watching him, and it kind of looked like Mary Poppins.
I was just going to say, it sounds like Mary Poppins. Did he go float away?
That's what we were calling him. We said, there's Mary Poppins over there. He was like only touching the ground every so often. He was just kind of floating along.
I love it.
Hey, Sally, I have another question. So people that have listened to you on this podcast or other podcasts or seen you on social media, you're always so positive. I can't imagine. What I want to know, are you that positive throughout a 100-miler or specifically this one, Badwater 135? Do you also fall into these bouts of darkness? And if you do, how does Sally McCray, who is the yellow runner, who is a positive runner, how do you pull yourself out of that?
Hold off on that answer, Sally, but think about what it is. We're going to bring in Sally's crew right now and have them answer a few of these questions. No, we don't have
to. Are you?
No,
the look on your face was awesome.
I was like, I can bring my husband and he can tell you all types of things.
That was rad.
We should do a podcast with my crew because there's always parts of the race in long races that I don't remember. And they had me rolling. Dave Daly told me at one point, he was like, Sally, just it's okay if, because I wanted to run like the whole entire race. He's like, dude, sometimes it's just good to power hike and run. And he said, I looked at him and I was like, champions don't walk. And he told me that after the race. I go, I did not say that. I go, that's terrible. He's like, you did. And I was laughing so hard. So every now and then he'll text me. He's like, champions don't walk, Sally.
I interrupted Scott's question. So with respect to Scott's great question, because he set it up so nice, he explained it. It was brilliant. And then I just got in with a cross comment.
Oh, it was fun though.
Sally, the yellow runner, the positive runner, do you ever get into a negative place, a negative frame of mind? And how do you pull yourself out of that?
Right? Like I go in that dark place and just get like, so the short answer of that is yes. In fact, there was two times in the race where I went to my crew and I just said, you need to leave me alone. And I think, you know, as we get older, we learn a lot about ourselves. We learn lessons about ourselves too, that we sometimes maybe we wish we could take back things that we've said or ways that we've acted. And I knew when I was hitting a really rough part in the race that I just needed to be alone and I needed to think and I needed to pray and just kind of be in the ache that I was in and work through it on my own. So there's two times in the race that I did that. And thankfully everyone on my crew, they've known me for a really long time, especially, Dave and Colin in races and in training, they've seen all sides of me as a runner. And so they just kind of, they clicked in and knew, yep. Okay. Go Sally, just work it out. But you know, overall from a mindset point of view, and I think that anyone that's done an ultra that's listening, I think even in road marathons, like you're going to hit those points where you start to question yourself as an athlete, as your goals. You start to question, why am I doing this race? Like, what is it that I'm actually trying to accomplish? And I think that in my training and in this past, you know, this career that I've had, I've learned that there are some things that I thought would work for me, and for example, like thinking that I'm so tough. I actually did a post about this, and my words were to stay courageous, not hard. And my whole thought behind that was, so often we go into these races or we go into pursuing a goal and we just think, I just need to be tough. Like, I need to muster up the strength, and I need to like just stay hard, no pain, no gain, and rise above it. And I think so often that can bring about a negative result where we then beat ourselves up when we're not able to do that, because it actually, there's not a lot to stand on when we're just telling ourselves to be tough, and why aren't we tough enough when things don't happen the way we want to. So what I did in the race, and what I've tried to do just more in my life as a whole, is just tell myself, like, yeah, this is hard. You're human, and feel it. Okay. Now that you've felt it, what are you going to do with it? And it's more about being strong enough and being brave enough, having that courage that this hurts, but I'm going to go anyway. This is hard and painful, but it's not going to last forever, because nothing lasts forever. And also just asking myself that question, like, when everything falls apart, who am I? Am I only doing this for, you know, for glory, because I wanted perfection, because I wanted to look great, because I wanted to tell this amazing, awesome story? Or am I doing it for something greater? And so, you know, whether it was in my training, I had some pretty rough training days, which I purposely kind of put out there and laid on myself to have some training and discomfort. But also I've had a lot of bummer races in my career. You know, I've had some highs and some lows. And as I said earlier, whether I'm at the top of the podium or I've DNF'd, I can always learn something and grow from it and realize that some of my worst races are where I've gleaned the most, where I've been able to grow the most. And so when this race started at mile 14 is when I started, my intestines just went south, and they were like that from 14 to 135. And I remember telling myself, when at first I first started cramping, I was like, oh, that's just race jitters. Like, that's not like, there's no way like that can't happen. And then it was like a mile later, I was like, holy crap. If I don't like stop right now, like this isn't going to go well. And then it was then two miles after that, then 2 miles after that, I kept on having to stop. And I remember thinking I had like a split second where I had to decide how I was going to react and respond. And I remembered, it was like I had this whirlwind, this flash of so many races in my past where I did have a bad attitude, or I was like, man, like, this isn't fair. I trained so hard. And I told myself, no, like, this is just something I'm going to deal with, but I actually feel great. My legs are so strong. My lungs feel great. Like, and that's what I told my crew. I was like, you know what, guys, this is just the other thing we had to deal with. Unfortunately, it's going to add time onto like this goal time that I have for myself, but that's all right. Like, I feel awesome. And I just kind of looked at it that way. Like, it wasn't a problem. It was just a situation that I would have to tend to, throughout the race. And I did, but I didn't let it be better than me. I didn't let it become something bigger than what it was. And just knowing too, that most people out there in that race, they're all going to deal with something at some point. Mine maybe came earlier. I don't know. But I think making it smaller and not letting it, be bigger than who I was really important to me.
So before we get too close to the end, I want to make sure, and if I've missed this, I really apologize, but I've seen in multiple places that you had a dream 10 years ago that you would win Badwater. And like, my literal brain wants to know, did you wake up from a dream going, I won Badwater? And then you're like, oh wait, that was just a dream. Or was this like a desire? Like, okay, I want to win. I want the literal, was it actually the wake up, or did you like, I'm putting this out there to the universe, this is my desire?
Yeah, I started following the race like over a decade ago, and it was such a mysterious race to me. And I, you know, and then I followed it like every year, but it did become, you know, like that little dream inside where I thought, man, I would love to win that race. I would love to be able to run it. And I went through years too, where I think it was, you know, a few years after kind of learning more about it, I learned how expensive it was to do the race. And then I was like, that's dumb. I don't want to do that race anymore. And that was like, I was really serious about that because I was just like, that's like, and then, but then I went and crewed and paced it. And I was just like, man, I really want to do this race. And then 4 years later, I was able to get in through the help of sponsors and things like that. But yeah, it really was a long time dream of mine. And not meeting it in 2018 was, you know, that was heartbreaking on many levels. But yeah, it was a dream come true this year, a decade long dream.
Hey, Sally, I'd like to go back to mile 14 to 135 when there was some intestinal issues.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the great things about being on the trail is you can find a rock, a tree. Yeah. You can kind of go off road a little bit.
Privacy.
Yeah. But what I'm seeing, from all the bad water pictures is, you know, you have maybe a cactus somewhere, one.
Yeah.
And then there's cars going by and you got to take care of nature.
So thankfully, like having known that course too, and then knowing like where the bathrooms were, there is like 8 or 9 places along the course that have a bathroom. Badwater requires you to carry Biffy bags, which for both those of you that are listening that don't know what that is, I had many people like, I had to look it up, but it's like a, it looks like a trash bag kind of thing. And then like at the bottom is like, it's almost kind of like a cylinder and it has like dirt at the bottom and stuff, but you're able to, you like wrap it around yourself, almost like a diaper. You go to the bathroom and then you can like that, it like vacuum seals up and you wrap it up and it can be stored until you find a trash can. But you use these things and through hiking, if you climb Mount Whitney, they require you to bring that out there with you. It's really just protecting nature. And so thankfully this is the first year my husband's ever crewed and paced me, in a race ever. And I couldn't have been more grateful for him because I was like, I don't think there's anyone on the planet that I would ask to do this, because as the race went on, I did get weaker, just my overall physical form. You know, I'm a, like any other human being, when you're losing that much from your body, you're losing nutrients, it's affecting you, especially because I was trying to push. So I'm trying to run hard and then I'm losing everything I'm eating every like hour. So it was about mile 50-ish that I needed to go to the bathroom again. And I'm looking up at Eddie and he's running out to get the Biffy. And there was like a big bush like right around. We found a lot of bushes and there would be like drop downs too. So we'd like hide behind the car. And then he had a towel that I had brought. So he'd hold up the towel. But by the time I was like mile 50, 60, just getting into that position, like my whole body was just like shaking. And I would have to hold on to his waist. And at this one point, I'm looking up at him and I just say, I'm so sorry that you have to endure this. Like, it's like 118 out here and I'm holding on to your waist as I'm like losing everything. And he just like touched my arm. He's like, you're doing awesome. I'm so happy I can be here for you. And I just started crying because I was like, you know, this is a part of it. You know, that's the beauty of this race too. It is very much a team effort. It does take a toll on you as an athlete trying to run through as fast as you can in this kind of weather. But, you know, I truly couldn't do it without my team looking out for me and being there for me. But yeah, that part was, it got tougher as the time went on. And I'd say by the time I hit 95, 100 miles, it was a lot better, but then I started puking. So, you know, it was always something along the way, and my crew did a good job taking care of me.
Hey, I don't want to go too far down the road on that, but anybody that's listening to this that's run some miles knows that chafing can be a real issue when that happens. When you have some you know, digestive problems, it could be one of the hardest things you ever have to do is try to get through that and manage it. Did that become an issue or were you able to sidestep it? And I don't want details.
No, it's all right. Well, and for every ultra runner, this is like standard, right? We're all just like, yeah, like bathroom talk's like normal. but no, this is real because I think that, you know, sometimes when people are new to ultra running, they are a little, you know, they're a little shy and taken aback by, you know, just what goes on out on the trail. But it's like, you know, we're humans. And if you're out anywhere for more than 5 or 6 hours, guess what? You're going to let things loose. So, but I didn't struggle with any chafing. Thankfully, we had some good flushable wipes with us. So, I was able to, I did take that into account though. I was like, wow, if I'm not taking care of myself, then this is going to cause pain later down the road. So yeah.
Good. Thanks for sharing. Go ahead, Scott.
Sally, we are 2.5 weeks.
Two weeks today. Yeah.
So two weeks post. What does recovery for Sally McRae look like?
Well, I'm going to preface that with, I've been doing this sport for a long time. So the longer that you do anything, and of course the fitter you are, a recovery downtime, all that is always going to look different. So, you know, the first year that I ran my 50 miler in 2010, I felt like I got hit by a Mack truck for about 2 weeks. Like I was not doing anything. I was so sore. I was in a lot of pain. I was hobbling. I recovered pretty well from this race. The first 3 days I was hobbling around because I did strain my soleus very slightly, but in the race I thought I tore it and kind of limped up that final climb. But I spent the first 3 days doing nothing at all because I really wanted to make sure that I was okay. So I drove straight from the desert to this sports recovery lab that sponsors me locally. So I got in the Normatec boots, I went to cryotherapy, and then I'd fall asleep every night with a Mark Pro, which is kind of like an electrical stimulus, right on that calf. So for like 6-7 hours every night, I was, you know, right away, just making sure that, okay, I need to make sure that this isn't like a true lasting injury. At about day four, I was moving really well. So then I decided to go to the gym, and the gym for me in recovery time, it first starts out with a lot of what would be for many of us like PT exercises. So a lot of body movements. I like to do really light weights and get in front of the mirror and just check and see where I'm in balance, any lack of mobility, lack of strength, see what didn't hold up in the race. I do that for about 3 days, and then I start, I actually start lifting really heavy and spend a little bit more time in the gym. I focus a lot on the upper body. I love lifting. And so yesterday was the first day in 2 weeks that I actually did cardio. I did the stair mill for 15 minutes. Today I did it for 20 minutes, but, my 2 weeks is mainly focused on strength training, getting the body strong again. I think it's, an area that's often overlooked for ultra and trail runners. It's such an important part of our sport, and I've always been an advocate for it. And so it feels so amazing to be in the gym and just, and getting the body strong. And I eat a lot. So
there's what I was doing.
Yeah, I eat a lot. especially the 2 weeks I don't typically ever really count calories. I just eat when I'm hungry. I eat for fuel. I eat for life. I want to be strong. I do like to have muscle on me. So I eat a lot of, you know, bacon and avocado cheeseburgers and sweet potato fries. I had donuts and salmon and just all the calories I could get in, and lots of green juice, lots of veggies to kind of flush out the body, a lot of fluid. That's really what recovery is. So starting tomorrow will be my first day running, since Badwater. And I probably could have ran last week, but, you know, for me, it's like, what's the benefit of that? Well, there's not. I think there's more benefit in taking an extra week, extra mm-hmm. time off, because in the past, I didn't do that. I think, and sometimes we see that in social media, people kind of be like, I ran 100 miles yesterday and I'm already out with my 10 mile run. But it's like, why? There's so much recovery on the inside. There's recovery mentally that we need to do too. If you've trained so hard for a race, your brain needs that break from focusing on a regimented training schedule. And I think that we can come back with more joy and excitement when we give ourselves a little bit extra rest than maybe we had planned.
Right on. Yeah. That's where I was headed with the fueling. When I think recovery, I think food. Like yes. That's the first like thing that pops up in my mind. So
it's
I'm glad
like
to
my
hear
favorite.
You're well on board with
yeah,
that.
Yeah. And Chrissy, I don't know if you were like this, but man, I was so excited straight from the finish line to go eat, and I can't eat. Do you ever feel like that? Like
no,
my eyes were huge and then I'd take a bite and it was like, it was so like nauseating. And it's terrible because the award ceremony was pizza. It's like one of my favorite things. I'm watching everyone like gobble up pizza and I'm sipping Gatorade. But it takes me about a day and a half for my body to reset. I think it's just its way of saying how angry it is.
Gotcha.
Can I have another glass full of Gatorade, please? Right. I didn't get enough over the last 30 hours.
Right? More electrolytes, please. Thank you.
Yeah, more.
Switch to Pedialyte.
Hey, Sally, what, in retrospect, 2018, 2021, if there was another one, what one thing would you change?
Like to improve for sure would, I don't know. I still feel like this is maybe out of my control. I think definitely, not having the intestinal problems would be great.
How could you change the intestinal issues that you had? That was kind of out of your control, wasn't it? Or do you think there's something you could have done differently?
My husband and I, like, so the 2 days before, I said something to Eddie. We were in the hotel in Furnace Creek, and I said, you know, my stomach kind of bothers me a little bit, but this is really common for a lot of athletes. Like, it's almost like your body knows you're going to race. And so you're like kind of jittery. There's race jitters. And then sometimes it's like, okay, is my body cleaning itself out? Like, it just knows like what's coming type thing. That's really what I accounted it for. Mm. I'm not sure if, and then even the day, so I raced 11 PM at night. And that whole day, even leading up to it, like things weren't 100%. But again, I was eating really well, though. I was eating well and I was sleeping well. Yeah, I think it may have been something that I ate the day or two before that kind of triggered something, and then throwing me into an extreme heat and situation just made it worse, because it actually continued for a day or two after the race too. So I don't know. Someone else was saying, like, in the Bad Water forum on Facebook, there were a few people were like, hey, they had eaten something, they had the same thing happen to them. So it might be that. But in my mind, I'll tell you what, as soon as the guys drove me back down to the hotel after I crossed the finish line, I was already thinking about, okay, so next year I'm going to do this, this, and this, and this, and this. Like, I'm going to train better here. I'm going to do this better. Because I did have goals for myself, especially time goals that I knew in my training. I knew that I could hit certain paces. I knew that I should have gotten up some of those passes a little bit faster. I know that I can run that race much faster than I did. I'm very grateful for the finish, but I do remember the last few miles climbing to the top and being sad that I didn't get didn't reach my time by several hours. So, and I think that's just the competitive spirit. And, you know, this is what I love so much. And I know I can always improve. I can always grow. And so I already have some goals and some ideas for next year, but I think I'm just going to go and I'm going to work harder. I'm going to be better with, you know, with my nutrition, and maybe I need to be better about those days before. You know, I can always work on speed and everything. I think I can just always be better. So I'll try again.
I don't know if you three would agree with this or not, but sometimes when something happens that you don't expect, that you have to back off and take care of and monitor, you can really have a breakout race because you controlled your effort. You started to become a bit more observant of yourself. You're taking care of you're not taking risks that you might not have taken in otherwise. And so sometimes when things fall apart, it could be a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think too, Don, you kind of nailed that. Like in ultras, we find that so often athletes actually lose their race because they went out too fast at the beginning. And yeah, they could be leading for 60 miles and then completely blow up and fall apart because they gave it all away in the beginning of the race. So, and then you hear people that have struggled at the beginning only to have like the fastest back half of a race and come out victorious. So pacing and strategizing in a race. I think that's the fun part of ultras. It really is a game. There's tactic and strategy into how you run a course, which is why I think it's important to study the course, to study as much as you can, to kind of figure that out. But yeah, there's definitely something to be said about having a little bit of setback in the beginning to maybe help you later on in the race to push a little bit more.
So Sally, knowing that story, if that happens to one of us, any of us, at the beginning of a race, we can plant that in our mind that this may be one of those stories. Instead of getting down on yourself and kicking the dirt and saying, why me, this might be one of those breakout stories. So in the beginning of a race, if you're 25% in and things are falling apart, that might just be a good thing.
that's exactly what Sally did. Like you said, like when 14 miles, this started happening, you like made the decision, like this is just going to be a thing. It's not going to be the thing that takes me out. Like I'm going to deal as we go. So that's, I love that.
Yeah. And I think too, it's trying to keep ourselves from, you know, asking that dreaded question, like, why does this have to happen to me? Why me? Like, oh my gosh, of course this is going to happen to me, because none of those things help. None of those things propel you forward. They don't give you the outcome that you need. And so I think in a race, it's first understanding like, hey, you signed up for this. Like this is actually supposed to be a celebration of the training that you put in. This is that thing that you signed up for that you're excited about. But where in life and anywhere in our life are you able to predict how things are played out? Like most of life, that's not how it's supposed to be. And so the way that it's panning out is exactly what you need. And so if this is what you need, what are you going to do with it? And I think that's a better mindset, is like, instead of seeing it as a problem and oh, woe's me, it's like, oh, maybe I need this. And even if it's something negative, everything can be used for good. And a negative thing can make you stronger. It can make you wiser. It can make you more patient, ultimately setting you up for something better, you know, in the future. And that could be with, whether it's in a race or a race that's 2 years down the road after having, you know, a bad race, you can come out stronger because you learn so much. So it's really just reframing that. It's not a problem. It's a situation. And it's not a bad day. It's an opportunity. And it's just flipping that perspective.
The sooner you can get there is so key. It's like, can take a while. Like we can go through all those thoughts that you kind of threw out there, or you can have that flash moment, like you said you did, that, oh, wait, I'm not going to go down that track. Choice. I'm going this way. I love it.
Sally McRae, you're always so inspiring. I listened to your story. I've never run Badwater for good reason. One, it's one of the hardest races in the world and it's very hot. But I listen to you and I say, I want to try it. I want to do that.
Yes.
And I've got and my love-hate relationship with Badwater has been, I want to do it. And then I get into just a hot run day and it's so miserable. And I tell myself, no matter what, Dawn, never run Badwater. And so right now I'm reminding myself, no matter how great Sally makes this sound and how wonderful it is to have diarrhea from mile 14 to 135, it's not that great.
When I first got into this sport in 2000, there weren't that many ultras around. And I remember saying, I was telling you guys, that I hope I never run Badwater or Barkley, because I had this feeling that I would get through all these races and those would be the ones I'd have left. Thankfully, the sport has grown massively and I have dodged doing Badwater and Barkley. Who knows? There's a long career ahead of me still.
Yes. It could happen. Yes. Chrissy, did Sally's story pique your interest a little bit more?
A little bit. I have good. To admit, same as you, Dawn, a little bit. I'm like,
oh, good.
But then, there's and I can quickly get to the, I'm not a roadrunner. I'm not a roadrunner.
Yeah, well, same here. And I'll tell you what, there... that was my goal too. I think that there's a lot of, you know, mysteries about this race. And so sharing my journey, whether it was through the training, the race, the post-race, I wanted to really portray it for all of its beauty, because it really is. I think the parallel, even just in life, going from the lowest low to the highest of high and traveling through this desert and ending on one of the most beautiful mountain ranges in the nation. I mean, it really pulled my heart. And it's been really fun, because there are quite a few people that have contacted me, some pretty stellar runners who said, I am signing up for that next year. I'm very excited to see the field that will come out next year. And you know, I love that I could play a little part in showcasing it in such a way that is pulled at people's heartstrings. But really at the end of the day, my hope was just to encourage people that, you know, no matter what it is that you're passionate about or whatever goal you have for yourself or something that might seem impossible or too hard, go out and try, because you just never know. I mean, the only way that you're going to get there, even if you fall flat on your face like I did in 2018, it's the journey is so exciting. And that really is the best part. I'll tell you, I loved the training for this. It humbled me in so many ways, but it was so fun. And the memories that I made with friends and just experiencing the beauty. I mean, the sunsets in the Eastern Sierra and in the desert in Death Valley are, I mean, they made me cry sometimes. It was just so beautiful. So the journey to any dream is worth it, even if it takes a decade. I think that's how we're supposed to live our life. So,
hey, Chrissy, let's you and I make an agreement. If she's pulling your heartstring, let's go out on a hot run sometime before you sign up.
Can I say something to that effect, though, Dawn? Okay. I do have to say this because I do like heat, but when I begin bad water training, it takes a long time to build up to. It's like anything. It's like when you're training in altitude. It's when you're starting to build up to your very first ultra. It's uncomfortable. But then it's amazing too when all of a sudden 100 degrees isn't hot anymore. I mean, literally, like you go out and you're like, wow, that was great. Like I'm able to like run like so well. This is awesome. When, you know, 2 months before I was like, oh my gosh, it's 100 and I'm dying. Like, how am I going to run when it's 30 degrees hotter? But so don't just go out on the one run done, Don. You got to go out again and again and again. Again
what
and
a salesperson. What a salesperson you are, Sally McCray.
I know, right?
Hey, Sally, one thing that you've done so well over the years, and especially for this race, is documenting your journey. And if you want to learn more about Sally's journey and her training up to Badwater 135, go to sallymcrae.com. And I don't even know what kind of magic or voodoo wizard you have working on your website, but you've taken all your Instagram posts and somehow weaved that into your webpage. Like I say, it's voodoo science over there, but you can follow her journey and her training. And it's really fascinating because for those of us that are never going to run Badwater 135. And in fact, Chrissy, if you and Don decide to run Badwater 135, you're going to have to really twist my arm to even crew you on that race. But my point is we can live vicariously through Sally's experience. Go to sallymcrae.com and you can relive that. There's also her coaching services there and just a lot of positive mojo over at sallymcrae.com.
Thank you. Thank you, Scott.
Hey, our co-host Chrissy today, she has some news for us about her book, Second Edition. What can you tell us about that, Chrissy?
Second Edition. You just already spilled the beans. It's right there. I am so stoked. And actually, super great timing. Today, I put the final manuscript, like edits. It's all laid out, photos, jacket, cover. It's all approved. I won't see it again until you see it in January of 2022 when the final version comes out. So it goes to the printer as of today. So that's pretty exciting.
Congratulations. So I'm going to put a reminder in my calendar for January to make sure that I get one of those copies. Now turn up the heat and run Moss. It's the end of the show and we would be amiss if we didn't thank a few people. First of all, the listener. Thank you for making it to the end of the podcast. We knew it was probably harder than running 50 miles, but we're grateful to you. We're grateful to our Patreon supporters. We need to talk about the Cocopelli 1000, which is coming up. Those Patreon supporters have bibs. They're waiting to learn more about that. If you want to become a Patreon supporter, go to trailrunnernation.com and click on the support us at the top of the screen. We want to give special thanks to our business Patreon member, Doug Crumley with Ameriprise.
Think of Doug as your pacer or crew for your finances because he will take care of you.
You can find him at Doug Crumley Jr., DougCrumleyJr.com.
We need to thank our producer, Doug Mayer, who helps put this thing together and gives us some direction. And importantly, sound man Ryan, who really makes sure that, well, we sound like we're doing our job, Scott. Without him, it would be chaotic.
Tune in next week for another episode. Thank you.